Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. On the morning after the 3 a.m. release of those three Americans by North Korea, on the morning after the testimony of CIA nominee Gina Haspel, in which she refused to say the agency's torture program that she was involved with was immoral, but promised she would resist orders from President Trump, if they were ever to come, to do more of it. And on the morning after the one-year anniversary of the firing of James Comey as FBI director, that, of course, led to the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller on May 17th last year, and Trump, in reality TV fashion, says he will decide by that anniversary, that is 1 week from today, whether he will voluntarily be interviewed by Mueller. It's the morning after the Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels legal teams traded accusations over the revelations of millions of dollars of payments to Cohen after Trump was elected president. Vice President Pence, in an NBC News Today Show interview this morning, without saying the Mueller investigation is corrupt or a witch hunt, like Trump does, called for it to end.
It's been about a year since this investigation began. Our administration has provided over 1 million documents. We fully cooperated in it. And in the interest of the country, I think it's time to wrap it up. And I would very respectfully encourage the special counsel and his team to bring their work to completion.
Vice President Pence this morning on the Today Show. And with me now is AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Jonathan, thanks for coming back on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Happy to be here.
So the Takeaway and the BBC, our lead-in shows, have been extensively covering the prisoner release. Therefore, we'll start with Pence and Cohen and Mueller, and we'll get to the prisoner release later. But can you explain to our listeners the extent of the new revelations about money paid to Michael Cohen by the pharmaceutical company Novartis, by AT&T, and by a company linked to a Russian oligarch reportedly close to Putin?
Yes, this is a surprising, perhaps, new front in the Michael Cohen investigation, in which it's been revealed that he was acting more or less as a lobbyist, although let's return to that in a moment because he's not registered as a lobbyist, but he was offering insight into the new president. And a lot of this is, you know, from, let's back up to the months and weeks after the 2016 election. Donald Trump's win was a surprise to most people. There was no sort of infrastructure already built around him, the K Street lobbying firms. American corporations, and in some ways perhaps international corporations, were scrambling to try to figure out what to make of him and how best to advance their policy wishes and just to learn what he was trying to do, what he wanted to do once he took office. Michael Cohen, his longtime personal attorney and self-described fixer, presented himself as an option to provide those insights. He did not get a White House job. He did not have an official position on the campaign, but he was certainly around. In my reporting in the last few days, former Trump transition officials say they had no idea that Cohen was doing this. The question is whether the president knew as well. Cohen certainly did have some FaceTime, some one-on-one time with Trump during those weeks, in Trump Tower before Trump moved down to Washington. Perhaps this arrangement was discussed. We do not yet know. Rudy Giuliani, the new face of the president's legal team now, in an interview last night, suggested that Donald Trump did not know. Regardless, Michael Cohen is out there offering his services and being rewarded rather handsomely for it.
Now, the way politics works, Cohen, as someone with connections to the new president, was allowed to take payments for his knowledge of Trump and his connections in various ways. So why is the relevance of these payments even breaking out as a news story?
That's right. It's certainly not surprising that people would, this is a pretty common practice to offer insights for sale. The issue is, it is another front for Michael Cohen, who, of course, is already under investigation for the payment to porn actress Stormy Daniels. You know, we know his office and home were raided not too long ago here in New York. And the question now is, where is the money used for the Stormy Daniels payment? Where did it come from? Did it come from Donald Trump? Was it funneled through one of these payments? That is a legal front. Now, Cohen's lawyers have said that The charges made by Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti, who's become a regular fixture on cable television, that he has been the driving force behind some of these revelations. And Cohen and his attorneys have said these are inaccurate. They said they've insisted they have not done any wrongdoing. What remains to be seen, though, is where, was Cohen peddling his influence and profiting with his relationship with the president? He is not registered as a lobbyist. Some of these firms had foreign connections, which would mean that he'd have to register there as well, dealing with a foreign agent. And those are things that, that clearly are going to be probed in the weeks going forward.
When you said earlier that the Trump team is saying he did not know about these payments to Michael Cohen, why would he be asked that, or Trump's people be asked that? What is the implication, if any, if Trump did know about them?
Well, I mean, if it is offering the suggestion that, if these corporate companies are paying money to Michael Cohen, the influence trying to get to the president is perhaps, and no one is suggesting this yet, but it's certainly on investigators' radar. Could the president himself, want to take a piece of this? Would it be influencing his influence his decisions? Now, let's remember, AT&T, one of the clients that Cohen represents, has a lot of business in front of the president, in front of the government right now. They're a major possible merger with Time Warner. But it also just goes to show this sort of thicket. Everything here is sort of linked. The Trump world, in many ways, is very, very small, and Cohen has become a central figure in the investigations surrounding this president. In fact, many of Trump allies, both inside and outside the White House, are more concerned, they have said privately, about what could be found in these Cohen revelations than even what Robert Mueller is currently looking to in terms of the Russia collusion part of this.
Right.
And so this is yet another front that's being examined.
And so this is where I think it gets potentially interesting and serious. If we assume that people don't care really too much what happens to Michael Cohen, that is, whatever he did or didn't do, and the legal system's response to that is not of that much public interest. What's of public interest is what the president did or didn't do and the legal system's response to that. And so now, through these financial records, we seem to have a Russian oligarch shell company making big payments to a Michael Cohen shell company. Does this begin to link the Russia investigation to the New York U.S. Attorney's Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels investigation in some kind of formal or informal way that's new?
That is the $64,000 question right now. Although, it must be said, a lot of the money actually behind it is American money, as you just said, the Russia shell company. What also is interesting is the idea that this would be something the Southern District would handle. Does that suggest that perhaps Special Counsel Mueller knew of this information? It seems like he did. He had interviews with some of these corporations, they themselves have confirmed, last fall. So one, this is another reminder that Bob Mueller's team is way ahead of where we know in the public sphere, that he's been onto this lead for months. But secondly, the fact that it was referred up here to the Southern District rather than kept for himself as part of the Russia probe could suggest, and again, we don't always know, but it could suggest that this part of it is not going to be part of the Russia probe, but rather into the examination of Michael Cohen's financial dealings.
And therefore Donald Trump's, or not really?
I mean, that is something we will figure out in the weeks and months ahead. It is certainly possible that Cohen, in this situation is walled off from Trump. We know that Cohen has been a figure under some scrutiny for a long time, and that some aspects of his business, the taxi medallions and so on, have caught investigators' eyes, separate from the president. But considering Cohen's incredibly close relationship to Trump, they're looking to see whether there's an overlap.
My guest is AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. And let's take a call right now from Carol in Wilton. Hi, Carol. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how did Michael Cohen know to contact these companies? Every indication is that he made the approach to these companies. How did he come up with the list of companies to approach?
Well, is her premise correct, first of all? Is there an indication that he approached AT&T, he approached Novartis, he approached this you know, slightly American company linked to a Russian oligarch who's close to Putin. What do we know about that?
It seems to be a little bit of both. Some of this is still emerging. At least one of the companies has suggested that Cohen reached out to them, that he offered their service, that he offered his services to them, trying to play off the idea that he has this access, you know, that he has insights to the president, he knows the president. There has also been some idea, though, that some of these companies have said they were just left scrambling after the election. They didn't really know where to turn. And even though Cohen was not an official part of the campaign, he was an ever-present figure and a known figure in the Trump world. Let's remember, he gave some pretty infamous interviews in the weeks before the election, including one where he scoffed repeatedly about the polls. You know, what polls? Says who? It became sort of a viral moment, and as it turned out, he was born out to be right, since Donald Trump is now President Trump. So he was someone who was seen as a business ally of the president, and he could have gotten on a company's radar where they might say, hey, let's approach him to see what he knows.
And one other thing on this before we move on, and this is a little in the weeds, but I think it's pretty interesting. Bank records like those are supposed to be confidential. So Cohen's lawyer made a statement last night suggesting that Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, might be asked to reveal who leaked them to him. And I think Cohen's suggestion is that since lawyer Avenatti doesn't represent the leaker, he represents Stormy Daniels, there would be no lawyer-client privilege there. So I wonder if the Cohen team is hoping the leak came from Mueller's team, even though it probably didn't, but what if it did? That would give him some, you know, an angle to discredit Mueller on behalf of Trump. What do you think this Cohen pushback is about by focusing on the leak?
Well, first of all, it seems to be a pretty common tactic from Donald Trump and his world to attack the leaker or attack the media report that runs with the leak rather than dealing with the content of the leak. So that's first of all. I think that's sort of a pretty standard tactic that we've seen from this White House and people associated with it. But it could indeed be more than that. I'm quoting a legal expert here who knows more about this than I do, who's more familiar with these things, but suggested that in the report that Avenatti helped steer around, it was at least on a couple of occasions a different Michael Cohen listed. Now, Avenatti has hit back and said, hey, 99% of what I said is right, but there are at least a couple of examples where it's a separate Michael Cohen, not this Michael Cohen, who's listed in the register. And the legal theorist who had experience with a U.S. Attorney's Office suggested that maybe that means it came off of some sort of database, it came off some sort of official government query system, and therefore could have eventually picked up a wrong name or two. That would potentially lead credence to the idea that this was leaked by someone in law enforcement. But you are right to point out that Mueller's team, for the most part, has been rather leak-free in the year that it has had this investigation open.
Patty in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is this. I know that the New York Times reported more than four dozen questions that the special counsel is interested in asking President Trump. Do any of these questions relate to the Russian oligarch paying to Michael Cohen?
I don't think that was on the actual list of 49 Mueller questions for Trump that the Times published. Jonathan, do you know any differently?
No, you're right. That was not on the list. But that list also, let's remember, is a few months old. And it's also sort of a rough understanding of what the questions would be. It was Trump's lawyer's interpretation of what the questions would be. It doesn't necessarily mean it's an exhaustive list. We are, though, as you alluded in your intro, nearing the deadline that Rudy Giuliani said the Trump legal team will make its decision on whether or not the president will sit for an interview. A lot of the Trump attorneys really favor doing this in a written form rather than having the president sit down for an interview. There's been some reporting suggesting that the Mueller team has nixed that idea. They don't want written questions. They prefer a face-to-face interview. And that's a prospect that worries a lot of Trump allies. People that I've talked to around the president have really tried to discourage him from doing that, even though he himself believes he can go in the room and clear his name. As one Trump ally had put it to me a few weeks ago, saying that, you know, Donald Trump, despite having a lot of history with depositions, that if he walked in there right now, he would probably perjure himself three times in 20 seconds. So I think that's something, just knowing how he talks. So that's something that a lot of people around the president want him to avoid.
Listener tweets, say what you want about Corey Lewandowski, at least he reported his lobbying clients. Michael Cohen, not. Ha. But I guess Cohen's arguing that he was not a former lobbyist and not representing them as a lobbyist in a legal sense. That Pence clip that we played, calling on the Mueller investigation to end as it reaches 1 year old a week from today, he didn't say it should be shut down exactly. He didn't threaten it in any explicit way. And everyone wants to see Mueller reach whatever conclusions he's going to reach as quickly as he can. So what was Pence really saying there?
I think this is significant on a couple of fronts. I mean, he did suggest, though he didn't say it should end today, he did sort of suggest that it should end soon, that it should be wrapping up. And as much as the president blusters a lot in person and on Twitter, calling the probe a witch hunt and saying that there's nothing there, you know, this is, in some ways, the most formal declaration from the White House. This is the vice president saying this should wrap up. And he's doing so echoing what has become a pretty common talking point. It's been interesting. In the last few weeks, Trump allies, including some members on the Hill, have said exactly this. They fixated on this idea that this probe has become a distraction. It has run on long enough. It's preventing the president from doing the country's business. And that is becoming the go-to talking point as Republicans seem to try to politicize this investigation as much as possible to make Mueller and Rosenstein, you know, not law enforcement officers beyond reproach, but rather political figures who can be attacked. And Pence certainly has pretty tight relationships with a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, more so than Donald Trump does. So if they are laying the groundwork to try to wrap this up, or perhaps to soften the blow, if the president does move to end this, you know, getting as many Republicans lawmakers on the record as possible saying, hey, this should end anyway, you know, potentially could be part of their strategy.
And in a way, that segues to our next topic, and my guest is AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Let's move on to Gina Haspel, the CIA director nominee. John McCain released this statement calling for her nomination to be rejected. He wrote, I believe Gina Haspel is a patriot who loves our country and has devoted her professional life to its service and defense. However, Ms. Haspel's role in overseeing the use of torture by Americans is disturbing. Her refusal to acknowledge torture's immorality is disqualifying. Now, McCain, of course, is getting cancer treatment, so he's not in Washington, but he is chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee still. And here's the exchange he was directly referring to in that written statement that he released, that her refusal to acknowledge torture's immorality is disqualifying. Here is Haspel with California Democratic Senator Kamala Harris yesterday. Senator Harris speaks first.
One question I've not heard you answer is, do you believe that the previous interrogation techniques were immoral?
Senator, I believe that CIA officers to whom you referred...
It's a yes or no answer. Do you believe the previous interrogation techniques were immoral? I'm not asking, do you believe they were legal? I'm asking, do you believe they were immoral?
Senator, I believe that CIA did extraordinary work to prevent another attack on this country, given the legal tools that we were authorized to use.
Please answer yes or no. Do you believe in hindsight that those techniques were immoral?
Senator, what I believe sitting here today is that I support the higher moral standard we have decided to hold ourselves to.
Can you please answer the question?
Senator, I think I've answered the question.
No, you've not. Do you believe the previous techniques, now armed with hindsight, do you believe they were immoral? Yes or no?
Senator, I believe that we should hold ourselves to the moral standard outlined in the Army Field Manual.
Okay, so I understand that you've not answered the question, but I'm going to move on.
Senator Kamala Harris with Gina Haspel, the CIA nominee. And I want to play one more clip before we analyze that. Here is Haspel with Senator Mark Warner, and though she would not renounce the torture program from the past, did with respect to the future.
My moral compass is strong. I would not allow CIA to undertake activity that I thought was immoral, even if it was technically legal. I would absolutely not permit it.
So you would not follow the order if you felt it was?
No.
And listeners, our phones remain open on Gina Haspel now, as well as what we were talking about earlier, or the prisoner release from North Korea. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, as we continue with AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire. Jonathan, how do those two exchanges fit together?
Well, it's a reminder that the debate on torture, these enhanced interrogation techniques, is alive and well, more than a decade after their usage in the war on terror, and remains, to many public servants, a real black mark on American history. It is striking that it's not enough, it appears to not be enough for Ms. Haspel to say that that the CIA would not use torture techniques going forward. There seems to be a demand for some public apology to say that this was wrong, a moral question about its use in the past. Now, obviously, let's point out that, these hearings are televised, and there are some senators, Kamala Harris among them, who are speculated to be 2020 contenders, who, it would be a good thing for them to be tough in these hearings. Ms. Haspel, though, has certainly a lot of acclaim on both sides of the aisle as being qualified for the position, but I think, as CIA director, but it shows just sort of where this nation is right now, wrestling with the issue of torture. And let's remember, Donald Trump, on the campaign trail, repeatedly endorsed the idea of torture, said that not only did he approve of waterboarding, said that waterboarding did not go far enough. Now, he has since backed off that a little. He says that a conversation with now Defense Secretary James Mattis helped change his mind, suggesting that torture doesn't really work. But I'd like to note, yesterday in the White House press briefing, Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, was asked if Donald Trump still believed that torture was effective, and she dodged the question.
And that actually relates to why some people are supporting Gina Haspel, even if they didn't approve of the torture program back then, that one reason for her confirmation is that her record is that she is a mainline intelligence community member who would stand up to Trump if need be to protect the integrity of intelligence and of CIA and generally U.S. government behavior. Is that a widespread perception of her?
I think it is that she is someone who, is seen as a person of strong integrity who would stand up to the president, perhaps on issues of torture, but also, it is unprecedented. It can't be overstated. It is unprecedented, the attacks from Donald Trump, a sitting president, on his own intelligence agencies, whether it be the disagreeing with the conclusion that Russia meddled with the election, to the suggestion that he himself was under investigation. Though the FBI has received much of the brunt of his scorn, there is a sense in the intelligence community that they're on very uneasy footing right here, that they are under attack from the White House. And I think that for some senators on both sides of the aisle, that Gina Haspel the idea that she would stand up to him is a comforting one.
Kevin in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Hello, Brian. My question is that if Gina Haspel said she was following orders from the higher-ups, isn't it similar to like the end of World War II when the soldiers said they were just following orders? Like, is it okay to do something if you were following orders? And I'll take my answer off.
Thank you for your call. Well, that's a pretty tough comparison. Would the answer to that hang on whether Gina Haspel genuinely believed that what she was doing by supervising part of the torture program was in fact immoral, or whether it was even in fact torture? Because I think the advocates of that program to this day, Michael Hayden, Dick Cheney, would say it wasn't torture, that waterboarding was seen as a legitimate technique. Now it's being widely seen as torture. But is it clear what she thought at that time in that respect?
It is not, beyond what you're hearing her say, that she doesn't, will not say that they shouldn't have done it then, that she will not say that it was wrong then, as much as she says that she wouldn't advocate it going forward. And I think her evasiveness did frustrate some senators. You heard the clip there from Kamala Harris, but also there's Senator Agnes King, independent from Maine, who was upset because a number of the records taken from that time, 2003, 2004, 2005, that logged a lot of what happened, were destroyed, and that Gina Haspel had a hand in that. And that is something that that makes some people uneasy. He has said, in fact, that he will, at least for now, he was leaning towards opposing her nomination for that very reason.
Yeah, the destruction of the records is another issue related to that. All right, people are calling on this. I'll take another call. Here is Lola in Norwalk. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
My question really revolves around what people say during these Senate hearings, and it begs to differ. Is she just speaking to get qualified, and then later on her ideology changes, or she realizes that, you know, I'm going to go with what my administration wants and follow orders? Or is she, you know, how do we know that she's really, what she's saying is really factual and going to bring fruition to the future? I mean, these hearings are I hate to say it, almost customary in that they just get someone's opinion for now, but later on that person can easily change their opinion or what they've said.
That's right. And we've seen too many examples of that over time. So I think that the gauge here is not just what she says, although that's one indication. The gauge is also the breadth of her career and her activities over her whole career, Jonathan, would you say?
That's right. I mean, these hearings are a bit of a political show. And, though as much as there are good faith efforts to learn the truth and a better record, but it's more than that. These senators are not going to make their decision up or down based just on a few hours of testimony. They're going to go back through her records and before making their decision, at least one would hope.
Does anybody say anything on either side of the aisle about the fact that she would be the first woman CIA director?
There's a little bit of that. Again, Agnes King, I saw an interview with him this morning in which he said that would be a good thing, that he feels like that would be a positive development, at least for him. That wouldn't be enough, for now anyway, to get his yes vote. But yes, there has been some discussion that's a glass ceiling that is overdue to break.
And I guess for some Democrats and maybe even some Republicans, if they're on the fence, if they're listening to John McCain's voice saying to not confirm her because of her role in the torture program, but they're also listening to other people's voices saying, you know, on balance, she's been a really good CIA agent other than that black mark on her record. And she has a record of supporting the intelligence community, likely to stand up to Trump based on her record if need be, unless she was just following orders in the torture program when she didn't really believe in it. Question left unanswered, I guess. That's why some people, that whole package is why some people are on the fence, and maybe adding to it the idea of a woman making history by taking the reins in that kind of high intelligence agency leadership position, which is still very rare in government. You know, maybe that's one plus factor to be added in for some people. Is she going to get confirmed?
It's unclear. I think the consensus seems to be trending still towards yes, but there's still a lot of undecided votes. And McCain's weight, even though he's not going to be there, I mean, his weight, particularly on this subject, his voice on this subject carries a lot of weight. So that may sway some thinking. I mean, the White House is certainly behind this. Last weekend, Ms. Haspel was sort of suggesting that she wasn't sure that she wanted to stay through with this, that she was afraid that it would be a distraction and bad for the agency. And the White House deployed Press Secretary Sanders, Mark Short, Director of Legislative Affairs, to sort of buck her up and to reassure her and to say, we've got your back, we want you to do this. And the White House, from their perspective, in addition to just believing that she's a qualified candidate, it would be a real blow here to have their handpicked person bow out. They have other confirmation hearings they need to get to. We still don't have a Secretary for Veterans Affairs. You know, considering the tumult in the cabinet on a nearly daily basis, it seems, I don't think anyone would be surprised if, whether it's Scott Pruitt or Ryan Zinke or any of those, you know, certainly with Pruitt at the top of the list, you know, may eventually be out the door. The president's frustrations with Jeff Sessions are well documented. And I think that this is a White House that doesn't want to have to go through another battle. They're trying to focus on what they think are some real successes, with North Korea, of course, being at the top of the list. I mean, that early morning scene, with its very much made-for-TV imagery of the lights and the flag and the president there, that's what they want. I mean, it's not, of course, they want to return the prisoners home. It's not all about politics, but politics are part of everything. And that storyline, that imagery of those prisoners coming home now, just probably a few weeks from this historic summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, that's where the White House wants to spend its energy right now.
And speaking of that summit, let's come full circle and talk for our last few minutes about the release of the three American prisoners overnight. And my guest is Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent. I want to give them the spotlight a little bit. I know so much of the spotlight has been on Trump and Kim Jong-un. I'm just going to read from the New York Times with a little bit about who these three people are. It says, Kim Dong-chul, a businessman and naturalized American citizen from the Virginia suburbs of Washington, was arrested in October 2015, convicted of spying, and sentenced to 10 years hard labor. Tony Kim, also known as Kim Sang-duk, was arrested in April 2017 while trying to board a plane to leave the country. He had spent a month teaching accounting at Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, a Christian-funded college. And Kim Hak Song, who volunteered at the college's agricultural research farm, was arrested in May of last year. According to CNN, he was born in China near the North Korean border and emigrated to the United States in the 1990s, later returning to China and eventually moving to Pyongyang. So what do we learn from these three? What did they do to be taken hostage or prisoner, whichever you think is the right word, by North Korea?
Well, you are right to highlight them, that there is so much about the politics and the particularly this president, but it should be something that is celebrated on both sides of the aisle, that they are home. North Korea, these are far from the only people who have been abducted by North Korea. It is something that the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, is one of his central themes as to how many of his citizens, Japanese citizens, are still being held there in the so-called Hermit Kingdom. It doesn't take much to get captured there. If you are to, seem to be defiling the regime or protesting the regime or protesting, the way of life there, that can be enough. If it's too much encouraging democracy or even free thought, that can be a way to hold you into captivity. It was a pretty powerful moment, of course, when they finally got home early this morning.
Trump has been implying, I think he might have even issued one inaccurate tweet. You've been following this more closely than I have, for sure. So you tell me, but implying that hostages were taken under Obama and released under Trump. But that timeline I just read, two of the three were taken when Trump was already president.
That is correct, yes. Two of the three were taken after Donald Trump took office. But yes, a few days ago he did tweet, a tweet that he has not corrected, and sort of blamed the policies of his predecessor, Barack Obama, not just perhaps for their capture, but for their inability to get them home sooner. This is, of course, something that Trump does time and time again. There isn't, you know, in some ways, there isn't much of an overarching Trump doctrine other than to do things differently than your predecessor, and while you're doing it, blame your predecessor. And this is another moment where he is doing that. However, it must be said, there are people on both sides of the aisle who applaud this effort, this diplomatic effort with Pyongyang. We're a far cry from last August, where he declared, you know, Trump threatened to rain fire and fury down on North Korea, or even back in January, where he boasted on Twitter that the size of his button, meaning his nuclear button, is bigger than the one that Kim Jong-un has, that we are now probably mere weeks from this meeting. Now, of course, we should all be cautious as to what transpires, to how to interpret what transpires at that meeting. There is some worry that Trump will be so eager for a victory, he will settle for something that is actually not in America's long-term interests. That all remains to be seen. But what's undeniable is there's more momentum toward this moment, and the prisoner release is just the latest example of that. There's more momentum toward this moment, toward a possible breakthrough than the United States has had with North Korea in a very long time.
And there are several lines of thinking about how this prisoner release came about. One is that Trump, by being tough and, you know, tough in a way that makes a lot of people cringe, but maybe is actually working with Kim Jong-un, led to this. The other is Kim Jong-un is playing Trump, just like North Korea has played previous American presidents, and doing this, which, of course, it's a big thing for these folks' lives that they're free, but it's a small thing in larger diplomatic terms, and they're toying with us, they're baiting us, and they're going to try to get some kind of deal that doesn't really denuclearize from the North Korean side. And just, you know, stretch it out and stretch it out and stretch it out, then blame us and go back to their program.
That is a concern. You're certainly right. A prisoner release costs North Korea nothing here. Though, of course, it's a great thing for these three individuals. The White House, of course, argues that it is the president's toughness, that displays of strength that got us to this point, not just the blustery tweets, but also that he's rallied the international community to have this campaign of maximum pressure on North Korea, toughening sanctions and so on, that has forced Kim Jong-un to the bargaining table. Kim Jong-un and the North Korea regime disputes that, even in the last couple of days, even hinting that it could endanger the summit if the president continues on that line of thinking as to why this came about. It remains to be seen. Donald Trump, as we all know, fancies himself the world's greatest negotiator. You know, put him in the room with Kim Jong-un. He has told people around him, and he will make a good deal for America. Kim Jong-un has proven to be a somewhat of a savvy operator as well. He's going to have his own agenda, one that will probably not dovetail neatly with what Donald Trump wants. So it is going to be fascinating to watch, you know, what transpires in those day or two, and, you know, and then whether or not North Korea actually adheres to whatever bargain they strike. And as the president keeps teasing, we should know within a few days the time and location of the summit.
Do you know the time and location of the summit? Because people are saying it behind the scenes.
The White House has not officially confirmed it, no. I mean, it is not not breaking news here, really, that there's a strong sense that it's going to be Singapore. The president himself, in fact, mentioned maybe a week or so back that there were only a couple candidates left, one of which was the DMZ, and the other one was Singapore. He ruled out the DMZ earlier this week. So by process of elimination, we may very well end up in Singapore, but that is not officially confirmed at this point. There was never any real suggestion that Trump would travel to North Korea. Certainly not Kim Jong-un would come here to the United States. There were some other thoughts that a third party could be involved, if not Singapore. There was a brief early discussion about China, but the Americans were sort of anxious about that. They thought that was too much of a home game still for Kim Jong-un. There was, of course, the possibility of somewhere in Europe, a Sweden or a Switzerland, a true neutral party, nowhere near either country involved. But a complication on that, one that perhaps would be striking in this day and age, is that Kim Jong-un probably didn't have an airplane that could have gotten him there, that the North Korea fleet is old and somewhat limited, and he did not have a plane that would have made it direct from Pyongyang, would have required refueling somewhere, which A, perhaps would have been seen as embarrassing for Kim Jong-un, but B, there was a real question whether a country would allow his plane to land in order to do that refueling. Yeah. So therefore, Europe was ruled out as well. Singapore is the leading candidate.
And the date, the month, the week?
Oh, in fact, you know what? Brian, I am going to break news for you. As on the phone right now, Donald Trump just tweeted, "The highly anticipated meeting between Kim Jong-un and myself will take place in Singapore on June 12th.
There you go. Well, we usually start by breaking news. Today we end our conversation with Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent, by breaking news. Okay, national journalists, Jonathan, maybe you included, change your vacation plans if you were going to be off in the middle of June, June 12th. Thanks a lot, Jonathan. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's going to be hot in Singapore.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.